From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a black woman judge in rural South Africa, Tandiswa Ndida's mission is to educate the people about the new constitution. It grants women equal rights, but many people in rural South Africa haven't even heard of the new constitution, and many men aren't prepared to give equal rights to women. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Ndida about her work. Also, the strange world of mushrooms. Why did people once think they were the work of evil spirits? And why did I once find mushrooms growing on my kitchen ceiling? We'll ask fungus expert George Hudler, author of Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Moles. And David Bianculli profiles tonight's expanded edition of NYPD Blue, in which we find out if Detective Simone survives his heart transplant. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a black woman magistrate or judge in South Africa, Tandiswa Ndida has good news to share with women. They are granted equal rights under South Africa's new constitution. Ndida is one of the women profiled in a new documentary called A Woman's Place, which premieres on public television Friday night. Since 1986, she's worked in a poor rural area called Mount Frere, which is very similar to where she grew up in the Transkei township. Many people in the rural areas haven't even heard of the new constitution, and many of the men, including some of the chiefs, don't want to grant women equality. They prefer to uphold the customary laws, which say that women are perpetual legal minors and can't hold property or inherit property. Tandiswa Ndida's early life was shaped by these laws. Her father died when she was just a few months old. I asked what happened to her mother after his death.
After the death of my father, my mother had to leave the homestead because she did not have a male descendant. That is, she only had daughters, well, four daughters at home. Some male relative had to be appointed to head the household. And that male relative, in turn, had a concomitant duty of support towards my mother, which he failed to perform and rather chased her out of the house, because she had no heir to the estate. So she had to go back to her home, try and build a new house, and try and earn a living. She had no profession. She had to earn a living by performing odd jobs, like making brakes for sale, working in a hotel, doing this and that to make ends meet for her four children. She had to put them through education. She had no money, she had nothing, but she did her best by doing all those odd jobs and managed to put all three of those daughters through college.
So she lost all of the family possessions because women aren't allowed to inherit?
She lost all the family possessions because she did not have an heir, that is, she did not give birth to a son. And because some male who was irresponsible was appointed to manage the estate, because she, as a woman, had no right to the estate.
Did she think that there was something wrong with the law?
She felt bitter. She thought that something was very, very wrong. Because she never viewed herself as, like, being less than a man. She always instilled it in us that, look, you're just people. That's all you are. There's no one superior to the other. You're just people. You are equal.
Now, in the village that you're working in, which is far away from the city, and there's really very little in the way of automobiles or any kind of real connection to the world beyond the village, a lot of the people there have never even heard of the Constitution, and yet your job there is to teach them about it and to uphold it. What does the tribal law that the people have been living under say about women?
The tribal law governing the rights to women is that women are perpetual minors. It is the same Administration Act, in fact, that governs the rest of the Transkei the Black Administration Act of 1927, which is codified customary law, and also customary law, which is not codified. That means in terms of custom, women are regarded as minors. They are subject to the marital power of the husband. They have no locus standi in law. That is, they have no place in law. They cannot stand in law on their own. Like if you are a woman, you want to sue someone. It has to be quoted that Tanda Zwandida, duly assisted by her husband, so and so.
So you can only go into court if your husband is assisting you. What if your husband is the cause of your problem?
You must be duly assisted by another male descendant from the same family.
Oh.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, that makes it very difficult, doesn't it? What are some of the typical arguments that you have been getting from men who think that this new constitution and the equality that it offers women is ridiculous, is an insult to them?
Most men feel that, look, the constitution is here to take away our cultural rights. It is in our culture that women are subject to the marital power of men. And it's not good. That's how they feel. It's not good. We don't need it. We want our culture to remain as it is. But in some areas, most chiefs are quite progressive. They already know that the law itself is made of social rules, and therefore social rules change with the times. So there's no reason why the custom should not change. There's no reason why the laws should not change. So they have already, like profiled in the movie, is another chief who has already in his area implemented changes like the right to land. He gives women the right to own land. It means that on his own, he has realized that there is a need to change the rules of custom, because I had not even been to him before when he implemented the changes. On his own accord, he realized that women need to be recognized as people in terms of the law. So you sort of get a mixed reaction, like some saying, look, yeah, who is she to come and tell us about our rights? I mean, she doesn't know a thing. The custom has long been with us. And this constitution, it's relatively new. It is here. Like, they feel like, oh, the colonialists again are here to take away something from us. So it's threatening, sort of. I understand the anger directed towards the new constitution. But there is a need to educate the people that it is not here to threaten their rights, their cultures. In fact, it is there to protect the same cultures and rights, but only to uplift the standard of women.
How do you explain to the people who want to uphold tradition that this new constitution is not the work of colonialists, it's the work of the new South African government? Nelson Mandela is one of the people behind it.
That's a very hard one. You have to start from scratch, because the colonialists first codified customary law, which was not codified. Now, that means that it entrenched rules that would be difficult to change. It would be difficult to change the law, an act of parliament, whereas custom, which is not codified, can be changed. It is governed by the rules that govern society at that particular point in time. Now, you have to start by saying that you know the history of South Africa. You know where we're coming from. You know when the colonialists took the land from you, the African National Congress had to be formed. Many other political organizations also came up. This was all fighting the rule of the colonialists. You have to tell them that we are where we are today because men like Nelson Mandela went to prison so that you can be freed. Your freedom is the constitution that we now have, because without it, there would be no rights guaranteed in the country. So it's a whole thing like, what do you know? What do you know? I mean, you are a woman, you are young. I mean, you can't tell us about her history. We were here, we know better. So you just have to have some patience. You have to persevere and come up with the story and somehow convince the people that the Constitution is the best thing that ever happened to South Africa.
I can see how it would get difficult and even confusing for some people. After all, you want to uphold respect for elders and respect for tribal traditions, but on the other hand, some of those traditions are very unfair. So is it, can you talk with the people there about distinguishing between traditions that are fair and traditions that are outdated and are unfair, that are hurtful?
Really, tradition is really belief. Belief depends on what prevails at that particular point in time. Like, what actually took away women's rights was the entrenchment of the codified customary law. Because customarily, men do sit around, drink with women, they mingle with women, they smoke with them. I mean, it's culturally, you don't see any real difference between men and women, that is with people on the ground. They are equal. They go to the chief's court. They have been attending the chief's court. It's just that there are separate places to sit. Like men will sit on the other side and women on the other side. They have a right to speak in the chief's court. They can bring action in the chief's court, not assisted by anyone. It is only in the magistrate's court that they have to be assisted by any male member in the family. I don't know if I'm answering your question properly. There are just too many issues here. I'm grappling with all of them at the same time.
No, I understand, but I think it's very interesting that there's a difference in a woman's rights in the chief's court and in, you know, the official court of the country, in the magistrate's court. So I think I see your point there, that the that in 1927, when the colonialists codified traditional law, they kind of set into stone things that would have kind of naturally evolved if left on their own.
Oh, yes, that's what I'm saying, exactly.
And do you think that some of the rules that make men superior to women would have kind of naturally evolved if the law was allowed to naturally evolve?
Those rules would have long evolved naturally if the law had evolved. Look where we are now. We have, we still have the Black Administration Act of 1927 operating, and it's 1998, and we have a new constitution. We still have a gray area because that Black Administration Act has not been repealed. So that means that it's sort of, it puts us at a disadvantage that customary law was codified by the colonialists. In fact, they needed to have control over the natives.
Well, it's a real topsy-turvy position now, it seems to me, because the chiefs are upholding laws that were upheld by the colonizers, that were poured into, you know, written into stone by the colonizers, and you now, a representative of the government, is really representing the force for change, the force of equality.
That is true, but if we take the history back a little, you will realize that even those chiefs were British imposters. They were put there by the colonialists for their own purposes. They got remuneration for being chiefs. Traditionally, there's no remuneration for being a chief.
Oh, so even the chiefs were a sign of the colonial government.
Oh, yes. Even the chiefs were a sign of colonial government.
My guest is Tandiswa Ndita. She's a judge in rural South Africa. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tandaswa Ndita, and she's a South African judge who works in a rural village upholding the new constitution, which grants equality to women and prohibits gender discrimination. She's one of the women profiled in a new documentary called A Woman's Place, which premieres November 27th on public television. Now, in the TV documentary, you seem very good-natured when you're arguing with men who disagree, men who believe that women should not have equal rights, that men are superior, and men need to have control. Is that something that you feel is important to do, to keep being good-humored in these discussions as opposed to getting very angry with them?
Naturally, you have to be good-natured when you deal with these issues. Otherwise, you could get emotionally drained. You know, you need to laugh at them. You need to laugh with them. That's usually my attitude when it comes to dealing with matters of gender with the males. What I usually do, I usually ask an appointment with the chief of that particular LRA. I think here you'll call him a tribesman. I first sort of try and conquer the chief to be on my side so that he introduces me to his constituency. And by the time I get there, I have him on my side. And it's not like it's just some heavy talk about women's rights. No, it's just a light conversation, which is eventually going to get them there where I really want them to get. Like recognizing that women are just people. They have rights like they all have. Besides, I have another added advantage. You see, I'm a magistrate in the area, so that means I'm deeply respected by the community. Now, usually in communities of a place like Mount Frere, a magistrate is seen sort of like a demigod, you know, stays next to the courthouse and he's sort of secluded because you'll recall that most of the time they had only been white magistrates. I mean, it's only about for the last 17 or 18 years that they've had a black magistrate and a woman for that matter. So they hold me in their very high esteem. So that's another advantage when talking to the community of Mount Frere. I've stayed with them for a number of years. And so that sort of adds some spice to their reaction. Like they react automatically to me. They trust me. They know that I wouldn't introduce anything that would take away their rights and their beliefs.
Now, I'm surprised in a way that you do get such respect. I thought that perhaps some of the men wouldn't respect a woman judge because it would be so unusual for them to see a woman with that kind of power, power over them, power over the men.
You see, after 13 years with a woman judge, you have no option but to respect her.
Well, did you get the respect early on?
Oh, no. The reaction was pretty hostile. You know, it would be like, oh, what does she know? She's not even married, you know. Even my colleagues, you know, say, miss, just to make a point, like, we put you in your place, you know that? It's just that in life, you just prove your point. I've been with that community. They have seen how I deal with their complaints. So they have no reason not to respect me. They are somewhat compelled to respect me.
What are some of the typical cases that women bring to you now?
Oh, I deal with a number of cases ranging from criminal cases, civil cases, domestic violence, inheritance inquiries, oh, anything that you can ever think of is dealt with by me.
Do you deal with a lot of women who are in the same situation that your mother was in when your father died, where the woman is being denied the right to inherit her husband's property, even though the new constitution says that a woman should be allowed to inherit her husband's property?
On a daily basis, there will always be a woman who is accompanied by a man saying that, look, he wants to take all the money. He says that he's going to maintain us. It's his duty in custom. It's on a daily basis that I get such inquiries.
Do you ever bring in your own experiences growing up under those circumstances?
Although in my inquiries, I try to be as impersonal as possible.
Yes.
it sometimes happens that you can sort of get carried away, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, when I really want to advise the woman to fight for their rights, I'll say that, look here, this is what happened to my family. You have the constitution to protect you. So why don't you use the constitution? Sometimes I do. I get carried away and think that, oh, no, she's not doing enough. Let me just nudge her to do it.
Now, when you rule in favor of a woman, and against the man who says, no, this woman is a woman, she can't inherit her husband's property, what do you have to do to make sure that the decision is upheld? I mean, does the man automatically respect your decision?
So far, I have not had any appeals. If they did not feel comfortable with my decision, that is the man, then they would have to appeal to the High Court and say that, no, the magistrate erred in holding that the woman had rights through an attorney, of course. But so far, I have not had any appeal from my decisions. I think it is largely because before I give any decision on the matter, I handle it traditionally, like we sit on a round table and a very informal inquiry. We talk and talk. The man is allowed to vent what he wants to vent. We talk and talk about the constitution until such time that by the time we reach a decision, we are agreeable almost about all the issues.
Do you think that the people in the South African government realize how disconnected the people in the rural areas are from the new constitution, how difficult it is to bring the new constitution to the rural areas?
The government does realize that there are problems with people on the ground. They know that they don't have enough public education. They know that they have not sold to the constitution to the people on the ground. So there are projects with the Department of Justice that are designed to work hand in hand with NGOs so that the constitution is brought to the people. But it is taking quite a long time, though. And I always believe that we have a good constitution, but what good is that constitution if it does not reach the people of South Africa? It's as good as if it exists in a vacuum, because no one will enforce the rights enshrined in the constitution if people are not aware of the constitution. I appreciate the work done by the Department of Justice, like public education, but it is just not enough. On the operational level, they need to get to those rural areas and educate the people about the processes of the law.
South African Judge Thandiswa Ndita, she'll be back in the second half of the show. She's one of the women profiled in the documentary A Woman's Place, which will be shown on many public TV stations Friday night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall Concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music. Available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Thandiswa Ndita. Also, the strange world of mushrooms. We'll talk with fungus expert George Hudler. And will Detective Simone get his heart transplant? David Bianculli previews tonight's expanded episode of NYPD Blue. Oh, This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tandiswa Ndita. She's a magistrate or judge in rural South Africa. Her mission is to educate the people in her community about the new constitution. It grants women equality, but many of the men prefer to live by customary law, which gives women the perpetual status of legal minors and prohibits them from owning or inheriting property. Ndita is one of the women profiled in the new documentary A Woman's Place, which will be shown on many public TV stations Friday night. Now, you have three daughters.
I have.
But you're not married now.
I'm not, yeah.
Are you looked at as being very strange in the community where you work?
In one way, you could say that. You know, when I handle these domestic violence cases, the men will usually say, who is she? What does she know about family matters? I mean, she's not even married for that matter. Who is she to give orders against us? She knows nothing about married life. And they would normally say to me, and why are you not married if you can handle these things very well? I said, then marry me if you want me married. Yeah, there was that kind of problem, like the man having an attitude. But it doesn't get to me because it is my choice that I'm not married. So I'm not bothered. And in fact, it is to make a statement like, I don't need to get married so that I can be recognized by society. I don't need to be in the sort of conventional family setting to be recognized by the society. I just need to be me and that's it.
No, if you don't mind my asking,
okay.
Were you ever married? And if so, did you have problems in keeping what was yours when you separated because of the law? This is
No, ma'am, I was never married.
So you never had to face what your mother faced?
I think that's one more reason why I never got married. You know that? It could be. It could be I was too conscious of the history repeating itself. It could be I was trying to avoid the situation where my mother got herself into by getting married.
Losing everything when her husband died.
Yeah, that could be one more reason why I'm not married.
You have two sisters, and I'm wondering if they also got an education and became supporters of the new constitution.
I have three, in fact.
Oh, you have three sisters?
Yeah. The firstborn child also has a teaching degree and an honors degree. She's not bothered with the new constitution. The secondborn child is a business person. She's very much aware of her rights. She's very much aware that she's in an abusive marriage, I must say. So she keeps on phoning me. She wants to know her rights. She wants to read every material there is to know about her rights. She's in touch. She's generally in touch with the law. So she knows the constitution pretty well. And then the other one is working as a physiotherapist in a hospital in Gofimvaba. That is my hometown. She's also very much aware of her rights. I think the eldest sister sort of closed herself from anything. I think she, since she was the eldest when this all happened, she just decided that the law was no good. She doesn't want anything to do with the law. When the property was taken away, she was there. She could witness it. In fact, I was younger. Those are stories I heard. I was only about 6 months. So she's like, no. I don't need the law to protect me. I don't have to know the law. She doesn't want anything to do with the law.
Because she thinks of the law as a bad thing.
She thinks of the law as a bad thing. Educated as she is, she doesn't like the law. She says that we had to go through so much suffering because of the law. So I just don't want to bother with the law.
Well, I can really understand that, not only because of things like the inheritance law, but also just apartheid in general was the law.
Apartheid in general, yes. Apartheid in general. You see, for us blacks, you see a lot of radicalism because the law has never been anything for us other than oppression. It was an instrument used by the colonialists to oppress us. That is why today you find that there is very little respect for the law amongst the youth of South Africa.
Now, what kind of position does that put you in?
It puts me in a very difficult position because now I have sort of deviated in handling the criminal cases I daily handle. I have to go in depth. I have to try and educate. I have to try and make the youth understand that, look, we are here now. The past doesn't matter. We need to do what's best for our country. I have a program I call Juvenile Justice where we go to schools. We teach children about the processes of the law, abuse. But there's not much time, you'll realize, because I have other matters to attend to, like the criminal court, the civil court, and the inheritance. So there's not much time for public education. But I work with social workers. I work with correctional services. I work with the SAPS in their community policing. Now, that's where we get to the youth of the district. And we want them to realize that we have achieved what we had hoped to achieve as a nation. Now let's respect that. That is the message we're trying to get across, so that at least the youth of South Africa can stop being bitter, can stop being radical, can stop being reactive towards the law. They can just grow with the Constitution.
May I ask if your mother is still alive?
No, she's not. She died in 1993.
So, but she was alive when you became a judge?
She was alive when I became a judge, yes.
And she must have been thrilled by that.
Thrilled is an understatement, yeah. You know that? I don't know how to put it. She was overwhelmed, like she wouldn't believe it. And when I bought my first car, she just wouldn't believe it. You must realize that this is a woman who was very, very poor. I mean, that's not a unique history in South Africa. We all grew up poor. I mean, us blacks, we all grew up poor. It's no big deal. We're used to that situation. But in her case, she wouldn't believe that, I mean, one of her daughters would get to be a magistrate. It just kind of, I was afraid that she was going to just die when I delivered the news. She fainted and just like, no, it just can't be true. It was so exciting for the whole family.
That must have made you feel very good.
It did. It did. I must admit it did. Made me feel very good about myself. It made me more convinced that, look, whatever happened to my mother, I will not let it happen to any other woman.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tandiswa Ndita is a judge in rural South Africa. She's one of the women profiled in the new documentary, A Woman's Place. It will be shown on many public TV stations Friday night. Coming up, mushrooms, tasty, toxic, and hallucinogenic. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Mushrooms are very strange. Portobellos are so tasty and so large, they're now sometimes served as the main course. On the other hand, some mushrooms are toxic enough to kill you. Others bring hallucinogenic visions. Three mushrooms once grew on my kitchen ceiling, but we'll get to that in a minute. My guest, George Hudler, is the author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds, about the fungus kingdom and its impact on our lives. Hudler is a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University. Before we get to the mushroom's place in the fungus world, let's see what makes a fungus.
First of all, is that the fungi don't have any chlorophyll, so that they have no way to make their own food. They need complex organic molecules as sources of food. They can't do that themselves. That's what makes them different from plants. Secondly, is that they have a relatively simple structure. There are no roots, stems, leaves, brains, legs, arms. The fungi are quite simple. There is a little bit of specialization, but it's not a tremendous amount. Then a third feature to separate fungi from some smaller microbes is that they are comprised of cells. The cells do have cell walls, which is different actually from animals, but the cell also has a nucleus, and that's what makes the fungus different from a bacterium. And then finally, the fact that fungi do reproduce by way of spores. And that's there are other organisms that do that, but that feature taken together with no chlorophyll, simplified structure, and just the general nature of their growth habit makes them unique as a kingdom.
I'll confess that one of the reasons why I wanted to do this interview is that one day, when I was renting an apartment, this was several years ago, I looked up at the ceiling of my apartment to find three mushrooms growing on it. And I was just appalled. I thought, this is a dream and I'm going to wake up, because mushrooms don't grow on the ceilings of apartments. What were those mushrooms doing on my ceiling? I should say that I did have a leak.
Uh-huh. Well, that's exactly why they were growing. They were mushrooms... fruit bodies, that is, of fungi that decay wood. And if you had a leak, that's all it takes. As soon as wood gets wet, it is subject to decay by a wide array of fungi, and that's what you were seeing in your apartment. In fact, that's one reason why building contractors go out of their way to try to ensure that water does not get into houses. That's why we replace roofs. That's why we have eaves. That's why we have gutters, is all in an effort to try to prevent water from getting into the wood that we want to shelter us.
But how do mushroom spores get into an apartment? I mean, I could understand it when mushrooms grow on rotting wood in a forest, but in your apartment?
Well, actually, it's possible that those spores were actually there way back when the house was constructed, and that they just lay dormant until they were moistened and were able to germinate and begin decay. It's also possible, I don't know how old your apartment might have been, perhaps it was constructed with wood that hadn't been properly dried. And so the fungus in the wood may have been there from the time it was sawn into lumber, but not dried properly, not completely killed, and again, able to just lie there in a dormant state. A third possibility is that one way or another, insects happen to carry the spores in. And, of course, insects pick up fungus spores in all kinds of ways, often inadvertently, but they can then carry them and drop them off somewhere along the line.
Now you're really making my day. George Hudler is my guest. He's a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University and author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. Now, you write in your book that mushrooms used to be viewed as the work of evil spirits. Why?
Oh, just because they showed up so quickly. They came up from underground. They oftentimes had a phallic appearance to them. But probably as much as anything, just the suddenness with which they emerged, literally overnight. You went from nothing to sometimes rather sizable appearances of these bodies.
That is pretty amazing. How do they do that?
Well, actually, much of the body of the mushroom is preformed in a relatively small conglomeration of cells. And what happens is that when they're moistened, then they just expand very rapidly, a little bit like maybe a sponge that's been squeezed together, kind of like the thing you might buy with in a gelatin capsule for a kid's bath, and then you put it in and the cells expand when they get wet.
It's really amazing that, some mushrooms are so delicious and others will kill you. Are there any guidelines for recognizing poisonous mushrooms?
Well, there are some general guidelines. I must tell you that I'm a very conservative mushroom hunter myself, and we generally encourage people to stay away from mushrooms that have rings around the stem and white spores and a cup at the base. And it's that last feature that people oftentimes overlook, because the cup is actually more often than not underground. But that's probably those characters, the white spores, the ring, and the base at the bottom, or the cup at the bottom, are probably the three features that I preach about most often as things that you absolutely must avoid, because those mushrooms are deadly poisons. Beyond that, though, I try to encourage people to learn to identify the ones that we know are edible.
Some mushrooms have substances that are hallucinogenic properties. Have you studied that aspect of mushrooms?
I have only studied it in the literature.
No, I'm surprised you wouldn't be curious enough to try it.
Well, I am, as a matter of fact. The problem is that when you do dabble in the hallucinogenic mushroom business, you run the risk of opening up the recesses of your mind and exposing sensations, memories, episodes that you may just as well have left suppressed. And I guess at this point in my life, I'm not quite ready to take that risk. But there are some other things to be concerned about. For instance, if you're not 100% sure of where the hallucinogenic mushrooms you might be thinking about taking come from, you could end up with a really bad experience. There are a number of instances where people have gone out onto the street with a pocket full of money to buy mushrooms. And when they bring those back to the lab, a large proportion are not hallucinogenic mushrooms at all, but they're regular old button mushrooms from the store that are dried and soaked in LSD or PCP or some other much more dangerous group of chemicals. And then, of course, there's also the whole legal aspect of this. The drugs are illegal, and I think for good reason, and so I guess I haven't been so curious yet as to want to dabble in that area.
George Hudler is my guest, author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. It's a book all about the fungus kingdom. And fungi are just filled with such paradoxes, because on the one hand, they can cause terrible infections. On the other hand, they can cure infections. Like penicillin comes from a fungus mold. And there's a newer medicine that comes from a fungus that's being used for a lot of the migraine treatments. Tell us a little bit about ergot.
Well, ergot has a long history in human affairs. To begin, ergot is a fungus disease of cereal grains, rye, wheat, barley, and the like. And when that fungus infects a plant, it produces a body, a hard seed-like body, that contains a number of chemicals we call alkaloids. Some of those alkaloids have very significant effects on mammalian systems. One of them will actually cause a constriction of blood vessels, so that a person who eats enough of that material can end up with gangrene. But that same chemical, given at a regulated dose and a relatively small dose, will aid in the treatment of migraine headaches. Another alkaloid in ergot bodies will induce spontaneous abortions, but if used in a regulated dose, can help to induce labor in a difficult pregnancy. And then there are yet others that are precursors. One in particular is a precursor to LSD, and these chemicals will induce convulsions, hallucinations, and a number of other unpleasant reactions.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because you say there's been some speculation that the Salem witch trials happened because people probably inadvertently had that kind of ergot and ended up having hallucinations and seizures.
Well, as historians review the history of the Salem witch trials and all that went on during that particular period of time, they note several things. First of all, the so-called bewitched people, which were young girls primarily, lived in that part of Salem that was down along the river. They ate a lot of cereals in their diet, particularly rye. This occurred in a year when weather conditions for plant diseases were particularly good, and it's very likely that a part of their diet may have included some rye that was contaminated with these ergot bodies. Now, these chemicals are known to have a significantly greater effect on teenage children. And the speculation is that upon eating these ergot bodies amidst the regular diet, I mean, they didn't just eat ergot bodies, but they were mixed in with what was presumed to be good rye grain, they got enough of these alkaloids to, in fact, have the hallucinations, have the convulsions, have these other reactions to the alkaloids, which were interpreted by people at the time to be caused by a neighboring witch. And I must emphasize that the role of ergot is still speculative, but I must also say that I'm impressed, as historians continue to examine the question, that the case gets stronger and stronger for role of ergot as a significant part of this whole episode.
Hmm. Well, George Heidler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Heidler is the author of Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. He's a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University. Coming up, will Detective Simone get his transplant? Will he survive? We preview tonight's expanded edition of NYPD Blue. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on ABC, in a special expanded episode of NYPD Blue, Jimmy Smits plays Detective Bobby Simone for the last time before leaving the show as a series regular. TV critic David Bianculli is here to provide lots of praise, but very few details.
Don't worry. I'm not going to let out any secrets about whether Bobby Simone lives or dies, or any other information about how the show's writers and producers deal with the departure of Jimmy Smits, the actor, and Bobby Simone, the character. This 90-minute episode of NYPD Blue is so good, it ought to be enjoyed at full force with all the nuances and surprises intact. What I want to tell you instead is to watch it for yourself. Do not miss it under any circumstances. Tonight's NYPD Blue is the season's best accomplishment to date. It's must-see TV for real, not just as a promotional slogan. All this couldn't be more different than 4 years ago, the last time NYPD Blue had to deal with the departure of a major star. That was when David Caruso, after one season playing Detective John Kelly, decided he wanted to leave the show and pursue a movie career. We all know how that turned out. After a handful of episodes into the second season, Caruso exited and Jimmy Smits entered. Back then, Caruso's departure, under angry rather than friendly circumstances, painted the show's writers and producers into a corner they appeared to want to get out of as quickly as possible. In the same farewell episode, Caruso's John Kelly was disgraced, he turned in his badge, and he walked out the precinct door. By doing so, he left everyone in the squad room out of sight and out of mind, including Andy Sipowicz, his best friend and loyal partner, played by Dennis Franz. This abrupt ending to Kelly's story rang false in several respects, especially in that even if he were to leave the force, his loyal friend Andy would still keep in touch. To have the character of John Kelly disappear like that, acknowledging neither his past nor his future, was a lazy way out. And to compound that sin, ABC promoted that farewell episode heavily without providing any preview tapes for critics. The network and Stephen Bochco Productions wanted all the rubes in the tent, but didn't want anyone out front warning that it wasn't exactly the greatest show on earth. What's different this time? Everything. In the very first show this season, NYPD Blue began with a dream sequence that didn't make much sense at the time, featuring Brad Sullivan as Patsy, an old friend of Bobby's who taught him how to raise carrier pigeons. But those dreams, like the storyline about Bobby's progressive illness, have gathered more force and meaning every week, leading up to the emotional resolution tonight. NYPD Blue this season has been like a novel, with a new chapter unfolding each week, and with the writers clearly knowing where they wanted to go. Because almost all viewers by now know that Smits is leaving the show, there's real jeopardy in Bobby's hospital scenes, and real anguish not knowing when or whether his condition will improve. Reacting to all of this, the cast, especially Smits, Franz, and playing Bobby's agonizing wife, Kim Delaney, has never been better. Tonight's episode begins 2 weeks after Bobby's heart transplant. In this early scene between Smits and Delaney, his wife helps him get dressed for visitors.
You done?
Am I hurting you?
No.
One more. You have like a little drainage. I wanted to go slow, buttoning over this bandage.
Okay. I'm gonna lean back now.
You set the schedule, Bobby.
I haven't seen this much action in a while. Is the bandage wet?
No. It was a little yellow drainage.
Feels wet.
I wonder where Dr. Swan is.
It's not like we don't have no time.
Yeah. Now we have time.
Paris Barclay directs this send-off episode, which was written by Nicholas Wooten and based on a story by Bochco, David Milch, and Bill Clark. There are no messy theatrics in the 90-minute installment. Instead, the drama is allowed to build almost by the sheer weight of concern about Bobby and his frame of mind, a concern that fills the squad room even after their colleague's bad heart is replaced. Tonight, NYPD Blue reclaims the crown, shared last season by Homicide, Life on the Street, and The Practice, as the best drama series on TV. Next week, Dennis Franz gets a new partner, former child actor Rick Schroeder. Life and television goes on. And in this case, it ought to be very interesting to watch. The male bonding aspect of NYPD Blue, the way Andy relates to his partners in a gruff but very loving way, is about to be tested and explored for a third time.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Joan Tui Westman, and Kathy Wolf, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall Concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music, available at record stores nationwide. Little Brown & Company, publisher of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.